compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
Good morning, everybody. And once again, thanks for listening to the Patrick Madrid Show. My number is 888-914-9149. 888-914-9149. I want to send a big shout out and a lot of beautiful love to the approximately 300 people who were in attendance at the event that I did last night here in the Quad Cities. Moline, for example, Davenport, and all the communities in the area. About 300 people turned out for the event at Our Lady of Guadalupe Parish last night. And also my thanks to Father Peter Zorgin, the pastor of the parish, who invited me out to speak. So when I asked at the beginning of my talk last night, how many people here have heard of the Patrick Madrid Show, about every single hand went up. So I presume that many of you are veteran listeners of the program, but it was nice for me to be able to meet you all in person last night. And I'll be speaking to you again this evening, as you know, on the topic of search and rescue, how you can help your family and friends return to a practice of their faith. So lots of beautiful love going out to all of you, and thank you for participating. I want to draw your attention to something that is kind of in the news, but not really in the sense of it. I don't think it's really sort of hit the mainstream yet. And that has to do with a volcano. And there are a lot of volcanoes seemingly around the world that are starting to erupt. I don't know whether there's any correlation between them, but one in particular that is causing some heartburn is the La Cumbre Vieja volcano. And you say that sounds like an excellent dish to try at the local Mexican restaurant. No, this is something different. This is a volcano that is in the Canary Islands, well into the Atlantic Ocean off the coast of Portugal and Spain. And I'll just share with you some of the news reportage on this issue. The reason that this particular volcano is problematic is because if the western, kind of south and western facing slope of the mountain, because this is an island that goes like straight down to the water, and if because of the stress and the fractures that are put on the ground in this mountain, if it were to collapse, that would send a massive amount of rock and dirt into the ocean suddenly. And the concern is that that would trigger a tsunami. And the tsunami would not merely affect the area there. There's virtually nothing, there really is nothing west of the tsunami, west and south. I'm sorry, the volcano, west and south of it is basically just the Atlantic Ocean. And so the computer models that forecast what a tsunami might look like, they show this tsunami that could be in excess of, say, 1,000 feet high, crashing into the eastern coast of the United States. It would also get up into Western Europe. It would cause potentially incalculable damage. So here's some reportage, and Cyrus will get a link to this for you so you can read it for yourself. News from La Palma, Canary Islands, where the La Cumbre Vieja started erupting at 3:15 local time, after a seismic crisis with more than 6,600 earthquakes during the last 8 days and vertical ground deformation. The volcano in La Palma in Spain's Canary Islands erupted on Sunday at 3:15 p.m. A small tremor hit the Las Manchas neighborhood before the volcano spewed out a great plume of smoke and ash. An eruptive fissure is developing, producing lava fountains and lava flows. Evacuation of people living in the nearby area is ongoing. The population of nearby villages were told to go to one of five centers to be evacuated, and soldiers were deployed to help them. The municipality urged residents in a statement to, quote, exercise extreme caution and stay away from the area and off the roads. Now, just to give you a mental image, if you want to take a look at some of the video, I retweeted that on my Twitter feed, at Patrick Madrid. But in other videos, you will see not just the volcano erupting, but you will see lava flows that are just rolling into these towns and just completely obliterating buildings and roads and anything in its path, which is, of course, what lava does. And I'll continue reading from this article, but you can see this if you go to my Twitter feed and take a look at it. Spanish television showed fountains of lava shooting into the sky and plumes of smoke could be seen from across the island. Stavros Melitidis, a doctor of volcanology at the Spanish Geographical Institute, said that the eruption had opened up five fissures in the hillside and that he could not be sure how long the eruption would last. He says, we have to measure the lava every day. That helps us to work it out. The president of the Canary Islands said that thus far no injuries have been reported. The prime minister of Spain, Pedro Sanchez, tweeted that he had been traveling, he had been planning to travel to the United States for a general assembly session at the UN in New York, but he had to postpone that trip. Flights to and from the Canaries are continuing as normal. The airport is still open. La Palma has been on high alert after more than 22,000 tremors were reported in the space of a week. In Cumbre Vieja, a chain of volcanoes that had a last major eruption in 1971 and is one of the most active volcanic regions in the Canaries. Now, I was doing a bit of research on this yesterday, and among the experts who were quoted in video and in print, one of them, I took note of this because the last eruption was 50 years ago, and this expert was saying that they predict that it's likely to erupt again. Now, this was before these eruptions, when it had been quiet. And he said that they predict that it could erupt in the next 100 years, or let's say within 100 years from the last eruption. But he said it's possible that it could take place even sooner, maybe only 50 years after the first, that earlier eruption. And that's about where we are right now. So this is a story that, at the moment at least, has not gained any major international attention. It's kind of flying under the radar, but I wanted you to be aware of it, for no other reason than just to be aware of it. Because if you were to go onto YouTube and do a search for La Cumbre Vieja and the Canary Islands and tsunami, you'll find videos that there are many of these videos that have been produced over the years. There's some from, I think it's the Discovery Channel on television, and other sources have produced videos. And invariably, they include computer models that show what might happen by way of a tsunami if this whole side of the mountain were to just slide right into the ocean and all these gazillions of cubic tons of rock and dirt were to go into the ocean. Suddenly, it would create a wave. And the way the computer models show it, the wave goes all the way to the United States and elsewhere, not just the United States. So, because that volcano is now erupting, it's definitely a good idea to keep an eye on it. And beyond that, I'm not sure what else to tell you other than be prepared. So I don't know if I would be booking a beach house in the Outer Banks anytime soon, at least until this volcano quiets down. Cyrus, have you ever seen any of those videos, the computer models of if that thing were to blow and if the hillside were to fall into the ocean?
No.
You should. You really should, because this is one of those things that for years, I mean, I've known about this thing for a long time, and it's always taken the form of if it ever becomes active again, if this volcano ever comes back to life, if it ever starts erupting, this is the problem that could arise. And as of the last couple of days, it has come back to life again.
This is terrifying. I'm watching the stuff that you tweeted out this morning, or late last night and early this morning.
Yeah.
This is terrifying. There's a river of fire flowing down a city street.
And do you notice how close the people get to it? It's like they're
way
not very
close.
Far away from it.
No.
Thankfully, it's moving slowly by comparison you know, to how fast humans can run. But I'm thinking back to, what was it, 1981, 1980, when Mount St. Helens blew up. And the video of that going up is just unbelievable. And, of course, that just destroyed everything for many miles in every direction. If you were within, oh gosh, if you were within 20 miles of Mount St. Helens, you were dead because it just destroyed everything, flattened forests.
That's one of my earliest memories is I lived—
Mount St. Helens?
Yeah, I lived in Medford, Oregon. It's kind of on the, it's near the border to California, so quite a bit south. Mm-hmm. And we were outside and it was like it was, there was an inch of, it looked like dirty snow. All over everything. It covered absolutely everything. And it was...
Don't eat dirty snow.
It was the ash.
Or something like that.
Yeah. Yeah, it goes something like that. But it's
something like that.
Yeah, I mean, it's, and
so
that
you
was
were a kid
hundreds and hundreds
when that
of
went
miles
up.
Away. Yeah, yeah, I was a little kid. It's one of my earliest memories is walking around thinking how weird it was that there was this ash all over everything. And
yeah,
lots,
I can imagine.
Lots of it.
I was in Southern California when that happened, so it didn't, that I remember anyway, it didn't really affect us down there. But one thing that was interesting was when Mount Pinatubo went up in the Philippines, and I think it was maybe mid-80s, if I'm not mistaken, 86 or something like that. Two things. One was, I remember how the light in the sky, especially around sundown, was beautiful. I mean, just amazing pink and golden light in the upper reaches of the sky. And as I recall, the scientists were saying that that had to do with the particles of the volcano that were up in the atmosphere and reflecting light. And I'm sure I don't understand all of the, you know, the meteorological details there, but I do remember seeing that. And then a few years later, I actually had an opportunity to visit the Philippines for the first time. And I went up to Pampanga, which is the state north of where Manila is. And I spent some time up there. And that is much, much closer to Mount Pinatubo. And Clark Air Force Base had been shut down by that point. And some of the people I was meeting with there, they took me around and showed me whole villages that were just completely covered with the term that they use there is lahar. This molten volcanic ash, not lava, but still deadly. And it just completely obliterated villages. I mean, you could see where they had been excavated. It's almost like Pompeii, you know, or Herculaneum, where you go there now and you see the streets and the shops and the baths and the homes of what once was this thriving, bustling city. And it had all been completely covered. In the case of Pompeii, it was covered with the ash from Mount Vesuvius when that went up. And it was weird because, I mean, many people died and it was just a terrible mess, and they were digging out from under it years later when I was there. So I think one thing I've learned is don't live at the base of an active volcano. Don't build a town on the base of an active volcano. That seems like a pretty reasonable thing to do, don't you think, Cyrus?
Yes.
Yeah. So. Yeah. I like catching you unprepared.
Uh-huh. I know
to
you
talk
do.
On the mic.
You have a sixth sense for it.
Sixth or sick?
Yes.
Or both?
Yes.
Yes. Oh, by the way, and I promised I would do this. All of your fans here in the Quad Cities, Moline and Davenport and the other areas around here, who were there last night, again, I mean, it's a phenomenon now. You have a cult following and people are asking about you. And they wanted me to pass along their kind regards. And they like you, Cyrus. They really like you.
People are so kind. Yep.
Isn't it true?
Yeah, they really are, especially Relevant Radio listeners.
Well, you know, I would agree with you. Certainly our Relevant Radio listeners are very kind, but not everybody is very kind. And some people can be very unkind.
We're going to have to do a nastygram segment. We haven't done a nastygram segment in months.
You know, that's a good point.
Yeah, we should do that.
Let me put, you better explain what you mean by that, and then we'll get to that in the next few days.
It's just a silly term that we use to describe the angry emails that come in, but we do take the emails seriously and we read every single one of them. But it's
sometimes twice.
Sometimes
three times.
Yeah, sometimes three times.
Yeah. No, you're right. We do very much appreciate when people send us emails, good, bad, or indifferent. We read them all, and we're glad that you take time to send us emails. And Nastygram is just our affectionate title for some of the ones that where you can just picture the person's veins are throbbing in their forehead as they're typing the email. But you know what, Cyrus, talking about people are nice. How did you put it a second ago? That people are nice, people are kind, and I guess I would say that is true, but there are some exceptions, and I found one recently. I just want to briefly share this. This is from the Daily Wire. It seemed to me that there was a lot of unkindness that was directed at a math teacher at a Missouri prep school. The school itself is called Pembroke Hill School, and it's in Kansas City. And here's how it's being reported by the Daily Wire. A math teacher at this Missouri prep school was dismissed after backlash from a small alumni group over her private Facebook posts, several of which highlighted her conservative worldview. The teacher claims that her liberal colleagues who opt to publish their progressive views on Facebook have faced no such scrutiny. Her name is Beth Reams, R-E-A-M-S. She spent 25 years as an employee at the Pembroke Hill School in Kansas City, Missouri. She facilitated the school's popular conservative club. In an interview with the Daily Wire, Reams stated that she avoided politics in her math classroom and she saw no use for it, so she avoided it. However, like her colleagues, she used her private Facebook page to express her own political views. Now, that's still permitted, I think, in this country, that you have the right, at least ostensibly, to express your views, freedom of speech and all that. So a slew of Facebook posts, again, reading from the article from the Daily Wire, a slew of Facebook posts reviewed by the Daily Wire found that Reams often posted conservative-minded memes such as, "It's racist to think only white people can be racist." That's not a conservative meme. I suppose it may be popular among conservatives. I would say, if nothing else, it's just simply common sense. To say that only a particular group of people, this is me speaking, by the way, I've detoured from the article for a moment, to say that only a particular ethnic group is capable of being racist is patently racist in itself. That's common sense. It's self-evidently true. So although this may be a popular meme among conservatives, I should think anyway that anybody who knows how to think would recognize that that's true. In any case, that was one of the memes she posted on her Facebook page. One post with a picture of Al Sharpton, you know who he is, a professional agitator. It read, "Good morning, America. What are we offended by today?" Ha ha, humor. I get it. Okay, that's humor. Her problems arose when an alumnus of Pembroke Hill, one of Reem's former students, sent her a friend request on Facebook. The former student, a young black woman, constantly challenged and, quote-unquote, went after Reams for her conservative values. Many of Reams' friends encouraged her to unfriend the former student, but she was afraid that the young woman would accuse her of racism. Catch-22. Reams described the environment at Pembroke Hill as, quote, hostile toward conservatives at the faculty and staff level, as well as for students. She said that following the 2016 election, she was harassed and given a hard time for her political affiliations. She said in August of 2020, as Pembroke Hill remained on summer break, she made a questionable post to her Facebook page. The post read, "The horrific truth is if people were told to get onto boxcars to be taken to virus protection camps, many of them would rush to get in line." She was confronted by Pembroke alumni who charged that her post had anti-Semitic undertones. Reams told the Daily Wire that she meant the post differently. She said, "I posted this because blindly following government mandates is what the Nazis did. And then I was told that it was read as the opposite, as me saying that Jews followed blindly to their deaths. No thought of that ever entered my head, ever." Okay. I mean, I suppose she could be disingenuous, but then again, maybe it's the honest truth. Maybe it didn't enter her mind. Reams opted to remove the Facebook post to avoid misinterpretations, though not before her former student could screenshot it and send it around. This is how it always happens. The punishment machine gets started up. The retribution machine gets cranked up. And when they decide to target somebody, as they did to this woman, that's the way these things start. Pembroke Hill's principal and the head of human resources requested a Zoom meeting with Reams in August of 2020 to discuss the problematic nature of her Facebook post. During the virtual meeting, Reams pointed out that the meeting was inherently political, as other teachers have posted on Facebook, and their political views had not been reprimanded for it. They had not been reprimanded for that. She pointed out that there were no consequences for a teacher who compared Donald Trump to Adolf Hitler, or a teacher who wore a Jacob Blake shirt with faux bullet holes in the back to school. So I'll kind of speed up the process here. So in an effort to save her job, she sent conciliatory emails to the Jewish community. The principal who worked with Beth for 20 years opted to give her a second chance, though she needed to fulfill requirements. So she went through the the obligatory begging and groveling and begging and groveling because she wanted to save her job. She needs to work. And so eventually, the way this all wound up is that she was given a renewal of her contract, but at a greatly reduced income because of all of her extracurricular activities that she would get paid for were removed from the contract. This, according to the Daily Wire, to the point where, you know, she's not going to be able to make it on the bare bones salary that they offered her. But as it looks in the article, she was willing even to take that in order to keep her job that she had had for 25 years. And eventually they changed their mind and they said that your contract is not going to be renewed. So they cut her loose and she now is without a job. I mean, at least as far as the writing of this article is concerned. I don't know if she's found gainful employment in the meantime. But I bring that to your attention because of her conservative views. She was persecuted and eventually she was let go because that was something up with which the people in charge at the Pembroke School, that was something up with which they would not put. And I find it ironic, I'll leave it at this, because if you go to pembrokehill.org, which is their website, and you go to the section on our shared beliefs, they give the, you know, the pretty standard boilerplate things that they believe in. We believe in fostering in our students the joy of learning, et cetera, et cetera. But they also get into, in one of their bullet points, we believe in creating and maintaining an inclusive community that welcomes, respects, values, and benefits from individual differences. And apparently they did not live up to that purported belief when it came to how they dealt with this particular teacher. They don't seem to be, at least in her case, all that interested in respecting and valuing and benefiting from her particular way of looking at the world because, as it appears, because she's conservative. So yet another casualty in the culture wars where this lady lost her job because the people who absolutely, or so it seems anyway, they cannot abide the fact that somebody may have a conservative political viewpoint. It just irks them to no end. And whether you're an alumnus or an administrator or you have some other position in which you can exert pressure, if the way the game works nowadays is if you don't like the fact that somebody has a view that's different from yours, even if you claim to be respectful of other people's values and that you claim that you benefit from inclusivity and diversity and tolerance and all those buzzwords, when it really gets down to it, those buzzwords go out the window when somebody's political views are just simply chopped off. That's it. So I hope that lady finds gainful employment somewhere. In the meantime, we're going to take a quick time out. I will be back with more of the Patrick Madrid Show, including your phone calls. The number is 888-914-9149. I'll be right back.
This is the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio and RelevantRadio.com.
All right, we are back. Thank you for listening to the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio. The number to dial to be on the air is 888-914-9149. Oh, Cyrus, I haven't heard this song in a long time.
Good old stompin' Neil Young. Love it.
So this was his response to Sweet Home Alabama. When Leonard Skinner came out with Sweet Home Alabama, he came out with this song as a retort.
Is that the way it went down? I thought he did this first, and then they were like, Southern Man, don't need him around.
Oh, no, you know, you're right. You're right. I have it backward. You're right. Cyrus, what would I do without you? No, you're right. So that was their retort. That's right. He wrote this, Southern Man, and that's why they have that line in Sweet Home Alabama.
Right.
Sweet Home Alabama. We don't need you around.
Yep. So the man don't need you around anyhow.
I need a cup of coffee. I need another cup of coffee.
That's good, though. Yeah. Couple of good tunes.
You know, the album, and I wish I could remember the name of it, but the Leonard Skinner album that shows them with fire behind them. If you look at that album, I should know the name of that album. It came out when I was in high school. But if you look at that album, the members of the band who died in the plane crash, are the ones who have flames directly behind them.
Really?
Like, it looks like it's coming out. Yeah, it's just an eerie coincidence.
Did you know that they were all on that plane? It wasn't just those three guys. The whole band was on that plane.
And those other guys survived.
And the other one survived. Yeah, I just found that out yesterday.
Okay, as long as we're doing rock trivia, one more, and then we'll go to the phones. I remember when somebody pointed this out to me, and I was really freaked out by it. Again, I guess I was in high school, and the Hotel California album came out by the Eagles. And you see this empty lobby. I think on one side of the album was this empty lobby. On the other side is the lobby's full of people. Pull it up on the screen if you want to, and you can test me on this one. So the band is in the lobby and a whole bunch of other people in the lobby. And if you look up at the balcony above all of it, you see this weird, almost like a devil figure, like a guy with this weird black out. You can't even tell necessarily that it's a guy, but it just looks like this demon that's standing there. And there was a big controversy, as I remember at the time, about, well, who was that? And was that intentionally supposed to be there? And who was that person? And I'd have to go back and refresh my memory on that. But it seems as though that was one of those anomalies that nobody could really tell who that was or what that was. So
I had no idea what you're talking about. So I just Googled it and zoomed in.
Do you see it?
I got shivers. Yeah.
Do you see what I'm talking about?
Oh, yeah. It gave me creeps. I've
It looks like a demon, doesn't it?
I have that on vinyl, and I've never seen that before.
Yeah.
Ooh.
I remember when somebody pointed it out to me, and I said, no way. And then I saw it, and I had the same reaction. Goosebumps. Weird.
Yeah, that's weird. That is weird.
Yeah. So that you genuinely did not know about that?
No, I had no idea. I have the vinyl. I have this, uh-huh, a big old, not the little CD that you can't see anything. I've got the vinyl, and I've never noticed that before.
You'll never be able to unsee it. Anytime you ever look at that, you'll only see that.
Yep.
Your eye will be drawn to it. Ugh. Yeah, that it is strange.
Yeah, thanks for that.
888-914-9149. Let's go to, where are we going? Friendswood, Texas, to talk to Noel. Hello, Noel. Welcome.
Yes, Lou. How you doing?
How can I be of service today?
Yeah, I just wanted to point out about the meme that y'all were talking about.
Which one was that?
The meme that the lady posted on her personal account.
Oh, the school teacher? The school teacher?
Right.
Yeah. Now, there were a couple of memes that I mentioned. Let me find the one in particular. The horrific truth is, if people were told to get back into or to get into boxcars, that one?
No, the other one.
Okay, so what is your point? What is it you want to say?
Could you mention what the meme was again?
Which one do you have in mind? I'm not sure. This is a long article, 8 pages.
The one about the one that's not all white people are the only ones that are racist.
Okay.
Well, what was that meme again?
I don't know offhand. What was it you wanted to say about that?
I'm just proving the point here is that history has proven that the majority of white people are racist.
Say that again?
History has proven that the majority of people that are racist are white.
How has history proven that?
The Nazis, the KKK, the white power people.
That's not an argument. That's just an assumption.
So I'm making my point that the majority of white people are racist.
So if I said that the majority of Asians are racist and history has proven that, would you believe that just because I said it's true?
I'm sure everybody is racist, but history has proven.
There you go. Stop. No, stop. What you just said just now is closer to the truth. It's not entirely true, but it's closer to the truth. First of all, it's entirely false to say that any given ethnic group is the majority of racist people in the country. That's just simply false. And history has not proven that, quote unquote. We can see evidence of racism among just about any racial group, I mean, I would argue any racial group at any given time can display members of its community who are racist, but it's just simply not true. And I don't know where you picked up this notion, but it's not true to say that any one particular ethnic group is the majority of racists. That's just not true.
Well, I'd just like to know why you're standing up to this lady in particular.
I'm reporting a story. What do you have against her?
I have nothing against her.
Then why does it bother you?
I'm just
why would you ask me?
Why
would you even ask me about why I'm reporting on this story?
Because what y'all are implying here.
What am I implying here?
That just because she's conservative was because she was fired.
Well, the
How
school
do you know
told
that
her that
to be fact.
Because the school told her that it did not like her conservative views on Facebook. I mean, the article's there. You
okay,
can read it
so
if you want to.
They don't have
it's
that.
All
they don't
there.
Have that right to.
What are you saying? They don't have the right to what?
School not have the right to see what she's posting.
Nobody said they
online.
Don't have that right. Nobody said they didn't have that right. Does she? Let me ask you a different question. Do you have a right to express your political opinions, whatever they may be, in public? Do you have that right?
Yes, and I do.
Okay. All right. So does that school teacher have the right to do the same thing?
Yes, she does.
Okay. So do you think it was fair that she should be fired from her job because she expressed her political views online?
If that's what the school wanted to do.
What if she were, say, liberal? What if she was promoting Black Lives Matter or promoting some other agenda? And what if the school fired her because of those views? Not conservative views, but what if she was promoting liberal views and they fired her for that? Would that be okay?
Yeah, that'd be perfectly fine.
Good. Well, then what are you worried about? Why does this story bother you?
I'm just, because you're reporting on standing up for this white lady, this conservative lady.
Oh, okay.
That has conservative views.
Wait a minute. So is it because she's white that bothers you?
No, not at all.
Uh-huh. Okay. You kind of slipped there, Noel. You kind of slipped a little bit there. What does it matter what her skin color is?
It doesn't matter.
Then why did you bring it up?
Because you said she was white. Why did you bring it up?
I didn't say anything about her skin color. You did. You slipped. You said this white lady, and then you changed it to conservative. You're the one who raised her race.
Yeah, okay.
Anyway.
So what's her race?
Hey, you know what? Let me share with you the words of Martin Luther King, Jr. He said in his I Have a Dream speech, you should read it sometime. He said, I have a dream that someday, paraphrasing here, my children will live in a world where people will be judged by the content of their character, not by the color of their skin. So I'll leave you with those thoughts. Martin Luther King, if you don't know who he is, look him up. He was a great civil rights leader, and what he said there is absolutely true. And if you are going down the path of judging people on the basis of their skin color, maybe you are, maybe you're not, I don't know. But if you are, then you're heading down the path of racism. And I sure hope you'll pull back from that. Thanks for the call, Noel. 888-914-9149. I'm looking at the clock. Cyrus, do you think we have time for another call? We're kind of cutting it close. Okay, let's go to Jorge in Milwaukee. Good morning, Jorge.
Good morning, Patrick. I just wanted to thank you for sharing your understanding of the truth of our Catholic faith every weekday morning.
Thank you.
Fantastic. God bless you for it. I have a question, and if I don't have to stay on if you have to take a break and then answer afterwards or whatever.
No,
but
we've got a little time. We've got a little time.
Okay.
We've got a little time.
So my question relates to God's perfection and his attributes of perfect mercy and perfect justice. Now, let me give you an example. It's easy to see the perfect mercy, but not the perfect justice. An example would be a person who, an adult person who's lived their life continually committing mortal sins that have been destructive to their family, their friends, whoever, showing no remorse and doing it for 30 years, 40 years. But nonetheless, our Lord established his Catholic Church, which provides us these sacraments for, supernatural graces. Right. And a person then, let's say, if it was a person on death row or any example, a person ill in the hospital, okay. About to die, but yet either they get baptized, and their soul is new. They're in a state of grace. Or they're in the hospital about to die and they receive the anointing of the sick. Same thing. The state is new. So again, like I said, it's easy to see the perfect mercy in those instances, but how is that just?
Well, I can answer it this way. Justice, keep in mind, is where you get what you deserve. Mercy is where you don't get what you deserve. And I'm going to try to talk about this in greater detail sometime in the next day or two or three. I'd like to talk in more detail than we have right now. So let's look at it where when God gives you, or rather when God doesn't give you what you deserve, in the case of the person who repents at the end of his life, and maybe is baptized even shortly before dying, he, by virtue of God's justice, he should be punished. He deserves to be punished for the things that he did wrong in this life. And yet God's mercy overrides his justice. And he shows mercy and gives the person leniency, clemency, forgiveness that he doesn't otherwise deserve. So when you see that kind of mercy, in other words, one way to think about it is that it cancels out the demands of justice in favor of mercy. Do you see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Hello?
Yeah, I mean, okay. I can you hear me? Yeah.
Yeah, so, no, I wondered if you were still there. Go ahead.
I do see what you're saying, but I'm just looking at it from the aspect of perfection, and I get it, one trumps the other, but it still doesn't entirely explain how is being merciful, and then where's the justice? Now, my thoughts were, okay, the justice could be in the fact that maybe it was while they lived their lives, they never got to experience the beauty of life as it is it was intended. I think that's one thing, but ultimately, they never made amends with anyone who did it. I was like, it's difficult for me in the time that I've spent so far contemplating about it to fully understand perfect justice in that act of perfect mercy, because none can be lacking in either one.
Well, in God, you're right. In God, everything is absolute perfection. But it's not an imperfection for God to give mercy to the person as opposed to justice. So I tell you what I'll do, just because we're out of time right now, and this topic that you're raising deserves a deeper answer, I'm going to make a point of doing that. So in the next few days, I'm going to give a more detailed explanation of this for you. I hope that's helpful. Thanks for calling. I'll be right back. This hour is sponsored by Ave Maria Mutual Funds, where financial goals are aligned with pro-life values and fund decisions are based on investment fundamentals designed to preserve and grow wealth without violating moral beliefs. More information at AveMariaFunds.com.
Compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show. Get connected to the conversation. Call now, 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149. Patrick Madrid is on now. Relevant Radio.
Welcome back, and thanks for listening to the Patrick Madrid Show. So this is the same song. This is
the
Hotel California.
But it's
in Espanol.
It's the Taco Tuesday version.
Love it.
Yeah, I love it too.
I've had some really good tacos in the last few days, Cyrus.
I know. You keep sending me photos of the stuff you're eating. I think you're trying to make me jealous.
I had some delicious tacos at a taqueria just across the street from the hotel where we had the Christ Brings Hope gala event. And I was on my own for lunch the following day before I had to go to the airport. And I zoomed in on the map to see, well, what food is available. And there is this authentic Mexican taco place. Awesome. And then again in Orlando, I was there for the JMJ Pregnancy Center gala event on Saturday night. Wonderful group of people there. Get to know them, by the way. JMJ Pregnancy Center. And they had their gala. I spoke at that. And what did I find? Tacos in the area. So that was pretty cool. Your
taco magnet.
I have a way of just sort of ferreting out where these taco places are. And you'd be surprised. Even little podunk towns in the middle of nowhere sometimes have a great taco place. Everyone loves tacos.
Fact.
Everyone loves tacos. All right. I want to shift gears here for just a minute. And we're going to go to the phones in a second. But first, I want to, if you listen to this program for any length of time, and the issue of suffering comes up, you've heard me refer people to a book by Dr. Peter Kraft called Making Sense Out of Suffering. And it's a very good book. And in a way, it almost doesn't matter what kind of suffering you're going through. But especially bereavement and the really big issue kind of sufferings that many people go through all the time. You get a diagnosis of cancer or a loved one dies or many of the things that we experience in life that involve intense suffering. It can be baffling to think about how is it that God would permit that kind of suffering? Why would God allow you to go through that kind of suffering if he really loves you? And that touches also upon the question of the problem of evil. The problem of evil is usually articulated along these lines, that you believe in a God who's all-powerful and all-loving, and yet evil exists. And if evil exists, that would call into question whether or not God is all-powerful, because if he is all-powerful, why can't he stop evil? And it also seems to call into question whether or not God really loves you, because if he really loved you, why wouldn't he stop evil? In which case, many people get to the point where they conclude, well, then maybe God doesn't exist at all because evil exists. And evil, it seems to them, at least on a superficial level, it seems to negate the possibility that this all-powerful, all-loving God actually exists. Because if he really existed, how come he doesn't fix these problems? So to give you a little sense of what you'll find in this book by Peter Kraft, and I have no connection to this book. Peter's a friend of mine. I haven't talked to him in some years now, but I'm just a really big fan of the way he approaches topics. So I want to share with you an excerpt from this book called Making Sense Out of Suffering. Here it goes. It is, of course, the most familiar, the most often told story in the world, yet it is also the strangest, and it has never lost its strangeness, its awe, and will not, even in eternity, where angels tremble to gaze at things we yawn at. And however strange, it is the only key that fits the lock of our tortured lives and needs. We needed a surgeon, and he came and reached into our wounds with bloody hands. He didn't give us a placebo or a pill or good advice. He gave us himself. He came. He entered space and time and suffering. Like a lover, love seeks above all intimacy, presence, togetherness, not happiness. Better unhappy with her than unhappy without her. That is the word of a lover. He came into our lives. That is the salient fact, the towering truth. That alone keeps us from putting a bullet through our heads. He came. Job is satisfied even though the God who came gave him absolutely no answers to all his thousand tortured questions. He did the most important thing and gave the most important gift, himself. It is a lover's gift. Out of our tears, our waiting, our darkness, our agonized aloneness, out of our weeping and wondering, out of our cry, my God, why hast thou forsaken me? He came all the way right into that cry. In coming into our world, he came also into our suffering. He sits beside us in the stalled car in the snowbank. Sometimes he starts the car for us, but even when he doesn't, he is there. That is the only thing that matters. Who cares about cars and success and miracles and long life when you have God sitting beside you? He sits beside us in the lowest places of our lives, like water. Are we broken? He is broken with us. Are we rejected? Do people despise us not for our evil, but for our good or attempted good? He was despised and rejected of men. Do we weep? Is grief our familiar spirit, our horrifyingly familiar ghost? Do we ever say, oh no, not again, I can't take any more? He was a man of sorrow and acquainted with grief. Do people misunderstand us and turn away from us? They hid their faces from him as from an outcast, a leper. Is our love betrayed? Are our tenderest relationships broken? He too loved and was betrayed by the ones he loved. He came unto his own, and his own received him not. Does it seem sometimes as if life has passed us by or cast us out, as if we are sinking into uselessness and oblivion? He sinks with us. He too is passed over by the world. His way of suffering, love, is rejected. His own followers, often the most guilty of all, they have made his name a scandal, especially among his own chosen people. What Jew finds the road to free him from the broken weapons of bloody prejudice? We have made it nearly impossible for his own people to love him, to see him as he is, free from the smoke of battle and Holocaust. And that is a brief excerpt from Peter Crave's book called Making Sense Out of Suffering. Now, if you like that, if that spoke to you, then I have a feeling that what you'll find in the rest of the book will be a balm to your soul when you're in the midst of suffering, or if you know somebody who's in the midst of suffering. Maybe you're not going through anything right now. The time will come. But in the meantime, if you have someone in your life, maybe even just an acquaintance, somebody you don't know that well, this is the kind of book you can give as a gift. And I'll tell you, it has really helped a lot of people. So again, I have no connection with this whatsoever, other than the fact that I appreciate the beauty and the power of the way Peter Kraft writes. And I share that with you in case you're interested. 888-914-9149. Let's go to Marie now in Illinois. Hello, Marie.
Hello, Patrick. Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I'm just wondering why the beatification of Fulton Sheen hasn't taken place yet.
I can tell you why. Okay. So the reason is, and there are multiple layers of reasons here. For several years, well, for many years, there was a struggle. I hate to put it that way, but that's really the only word I can think of that describes it adequately. There was a struggle between the home diocese of Archbishop Fulton Sheen, which is Peoria in Illinois, not far from where I am today, and the Archdiocese of New York, where he had been an auxiliary bishop before he was made the Bishop of Rochester. Now, his remains were interred in St. Patrick's Cathedral in New York City, and as the progress of his cause for canonization moved forward, the Diocese of Peoria wanted his remains translated to the Diocese of Peoria because that was his home diocese. He was born in El Paso, Illinois, which is out in the hinterlands in the Diocese of Peoria. So there was a struggle that went on for years between the two dioceses, and the Archdiocese of New York was, to say reluctant might not be quite a strong enough word. They were unwilling, perhaps, to allow the remains of Archbishop Sheen to be moved. Well, eventually, as things began to wind their way through the courts, and as I understand it, at least, the struggle went in favor of the Diocese of Peoria, and great plans were being made for the beatification. The date was set for the beatification. It would have been a couple of years ago, as I recall. And everything was making progress. The remains of Fulton Sheen had been moved. All of those details had been taken care of. And then suddenly, without warning, out of the blue, a member of the clergy, this was a bishop in the East, he at first it was anonymous, but then eventually his name was revealed, that he said that there was somebody who said that an abuse of a minor was taking place in, and I forget the specific details, whether it was in a rectory or it was in a chancery office. I'd have to go back and look at the details. But the claim was that somebody had said, not like under oath and not, this was never, I'll just say what was said. What was said was that Fulton Sheen happened to pass by this, oh my gosh. Okay. I got to tell you the rest of the story, and I will tell you that on the other side of this timeout. I guess that's a great way to tease an upcoming segment. So if you want to know all the details about why Archbishop Fulton Sheen's cause for beatification stalled, I will tell you when we come back from this quick timeout. Please stay right there.